everyone. Thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's August 2019, and you're listening to episode 138 of Postmodern Realities. And this is going to be a conversation about NBC's television series, The Good Place. On this episode, I'm joined by Melissa Kane Travis. Melissa has a PhD from Faulkner University in humanities with a concentration in philosophy, and she is an assistant professor at Houston Baptist University, where she teaches graduate courses in science and faith and philosophy of religion. Melissa is also the author of Science and the Mind of the Maker, What the Conversation Between Faith and Science Reveals About God. Melissa has written an online exclusive television series review about The Good Place, and it's available free online at her website, equip.org, and it's called Using NBC's The Good Place in Conversational Apologetics. Melissa, it's good to have you on.
Thank you. This is going to be fun.
Yes. Well, I also want to say to our listeners that this is going to be full of spoilers. So if you haven't yet watched The Good Place and you're interested in watching this television series, you might want to stop this and come back to it after you have watched the first three seasons, which are available. Two of them you can stream on Netflix, and one you might have to buy on iTunes or wherever you buy your shows. Well, this is a television series that was created by Michael Schur. So if people are fans of the comedy series The Office or Parks and Recreation, he worked on that show, and he created this television series for NBC, and it has three seasons, and the fourth season is going to start, and it's going to be the final season, and it's going to be next month on September 26th. So that's when it is starting. So for listeners who've never watched The Good Place, and I highly recommend that you do, I'd like you to explain the premise of the show, some of the characters, and what makes it different from other sitcoms. And I will preface it by saying this. I don't think I watched it until recently because I thought it would be something that was very profane, very mocking of Christianity. And it's not like that at all. So I was very surprised when I started watching the show.
Yeah, I was too. So I'll try to keep spoilers to a minimum while I try to explain what the show's all about. So in the very first episode of The Good Place, we get the setup of the entire story. There's this young woman, her name is Eleanor, and she's died and she's arrived in the afterlife. And she's greeted by this white-haired guy in a bow tie. He's sort of this angel figure, and appropriately, his name is Michael. And Michael explains to Eleanor that she's died, that she's in the afterlife, and that it's the good place, not the bad place, where she's going to spend eternity. So then he takes her on this tour of her afterlife neighborhood, and it's this picturesque little town. It has like cobblestone streets and quaint little shops and European-looking cafes, and the sun's shining, flowers are blooming everywhere, and you see these happy, smiling people strolling around hand in hand. It's just all very idyllic. And then all the residents gather together in the town square, and Michael shows them this orientation video. And that's a very important scene because that's where we learn something that's absolutely central to the plot of the entire show. And that is how the moral economy works in this fictional universe. It turns out that there's this mathematical accounting system, and this system tracks every single action throughout an individual person's life. So each action's worth a certain number of positive or negative points, depending upon how much goodness or badness it ended up causing in the universe over time. So it takes into account the whole ripple effect of every action that we perform throughout our lifetime. And so the orientation video shows this hilarious animation that's made up of all sorts of examples of human actions along with their respective points values. So there are these major things like genocide, which is worth a super high number of negative points. And then there's abolishing slavery, which is worth a super high number of positive points. And then sprinkled all in there are these silly little minor things. One of them says, ruining an opera with boorish behavior, and that's worth like negative 90 points. So anyway, all the points that are accumulated and lost over someone's lifetime are all tallied up, and then the people with the very highest scores are the only ones that get into the good place. So Michael calls it the cream of the crop, the best of the best. And then to top it all off, when you make it into the good place, you're paired up with your perfect soulmate for all of eternity. And Eleanor finds out that her soulmate is a man named Chidi Anagonye, who has spent his earthly life as a professor of moral philosophy. Now, in this first episode, the big conflict arises that's important to the entire three seasons of the show that have aired so far. The problem is Eleanor realizes that there's been a massive mistake, that because she's not the person that Michael thinks she is. So he mentions her career as an attorney who worked to get innocent people off death row. And then he shows her these film clips of her humanitarian work in a third world country, but it's shown as if it is her memories through her own eyes. So you don't see the person on the screen who's doing the humanitarian work. But Eleanor knows that these aren't her memories. She obviously knows that she wasn't an attorney who got people off death row. So she's terrified, and she begs Chidi, her soulmate, the moral philosopher, to teach her how to be a good person, because she wants to legitimately earn her right to stay in the good place. So that's the big setup and conflict for the whole rest of the series. Now, what makes this show so unique, as you said, compared to other sitcoms, is that over all the subsequent episodes, amidst all the drama and all the comedy, which sometimes can get mildly bawdy, but I would still say it's a pretty family-friendly show. But over all the subsequent episodes, Chidi starts giving Eleanor formal lessons in moral philosophy. And the script writers for the show actually used university philosophy professors as their content consultants. So there was one from UCLA and there was one from Clemson University. And this is awesome because the result is that the philosophical content of the show is very, very good. So through Chidi's lessons and then his situational conversations with Eleanor and some of the other human characters, viewers get introduced to several different schools of thought about ethics, and then quite a few major figures from Western philosophy and some of the concepts that they introduced into Western thinking about morality and ethics. Interestingly, the topic of religion is completely avoided. It's very much a secular storyline. But as it plays out over the three seasons, the characters of the show find themselves in all of these different situations. Often they're very, very funny, but they lead to philosophical discussions about moral choices, or they wind up in some dilemma that kind of results from them trying to live out one of the particular theories of morality that have been introduced in one of Chidi's lessons. So some of the illustrations are hilarious, but they're very well done. And the end result is that viewers become intrigued with this topic of moral philosophy, and this might be something they've never really given much serious thought to. And so the bottom line is the central question of the entire show, a sitcom no less, is the question, what does it mean to be good?
Yes, I did think that was really fascinating, because in this show, they kind of follow around four main characters. So you just mentioned, you know, it starts with Eleanor Shellstrop, who has died. And then there's this professor, Chidi Anagonye. And then there are two other main characters, one called Jianyu Li, who has been a Buddhist monk. And then another one who's been like a British socialite, Tahani, who has all these really famous celebrity friends, and she's done all these big charitable, raising multi-millions of dollars. And those two together are soulmates, Jianyu and Tahani. And so following this around, like you said, it's really fascinating. You know, it's asking, like, what are good deeds? What motivates you to do good deeds? What motivates anyone to do anything? And how do we know the ramifications of all of our choices? And so those kinds of things that people maybe don't necessarily think about, especially people who are not religious, I found really fascinating. And like you said, it doesn't discuss any particular religion. So I thought it really was going to be a discussion of, you know, Christianity, but it's really not like that. It's kind of, there is no religion per se in the sense that we think of religion as specifically like monotheistic religions with heaven and hell. It's just this idea of the afterlife, right? So how do you think the writers manage that? It's very creative what they've done to put them in all to these different situations, but how do you think they've managed to make you think very deeply about some of these philosophical and religious questions, yet not point to any specific religion?
Well, they actually take a very explicit tack in the very first episode in order to circumvent the entire topic of religion. So when Michael's explaining to Eleanor Shellstrop that she's died and she's entered what he calls the next phase of her existence in the universe, Eleanor just flat out asks him, she says, "So who was right about all this?" And Michael says, "Well, let's see, Hindus are a little bit right, Muslims a little bit, Jews, Christians, Buddhists, every religion guessed about 5%. And then he goes on to tell her that the traditional concepts of heaven and hell that she grew up with aren't exactly correct, but there are indeed two places, one good and one bad, that people can go to in the afterlife. So this is the only scene in all three seasons of the show where the question of how religion relates to the afterlife is mentioned at all. Just in one quick, efficient swoop, they dismiss religion altogether. And then the theories of moral philosophy that become part of the storyline are all secular attempts to make sense of morality without having to talk about religion or even the existence of God. But as a side note, it's really interesting to me that the writers of the show named the moral philosopher Chidi, because the translation of that name is the phrase "God exists." I thought that was a bit ironic.
Yeah, that is really interesting. And that seems, this idea that you're talking about, they're only partially correct with each of these major world religions. But then they do mention something that comes up a couple seasons later about one guy who figured out their point system, and he was like 90% right. And the people running it were very surprised by that.
Yeah. Doug Forsett. So this hippie in the 1970s who was tripping on magic mushrooms and just started talking about his theory of the afterlife. So he came closest to getting it all right, according to Michael.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Melissa Kane Travis, and she has written an online exclusive television series review. It's available free at our website, equip.org, and it's called "Using NBC's The Good Place in Conversational Apologetics." I'd also like to invite you to subscribe to the journal, because when you subscribe, you join our team of print subscribers, and your paid subscription helps to provide this free podcast to you and others that listen to it, as well as articles like Melissa's article on The Good Place, which are completely free online because our website, equip.org, has no paywall. So we really appreciate you supporting us by subscribing to the journal. The other thing is, if a journal subscription is not in your budget for this month, one way that you can support us is to leave us a tip, and you can do that by going to our website, going to magazine. In the drop-down menu, you'll see PMR podcast. Click on that, find this landing page for The Good Place, and there we have a link where you can leave us a tip, and it could be a small amount, like $3 or $5, which is for some people just the cost of a latte or a lunch out or something like that. And it's just a way for you to say thank you for this content and help to have us continue to produce this free content for you. Or maybe just a tip of $10 or $15, which is basically the cost of 1 month of your streaming service that you get your TV shows and your movies on. So we want to thank you for being a partner with us. and helping to provide these resources, not just for you, but also for many people around the world who come to our website looking for answers. And so this puts these really practical apologetics and also discipleship resources right at the hands and your fingertips, completely free to others. So we appreciate your support and for your subscription. In your article, you specifically mention a running theme in The Good Place, the idea that as human beings living in society, we owe it to one another to behave in certain ways. Can you unpack that and talk about why that's a useful idea in conversational apologetics?
Yes. So the show strongly promotes this claim that human beings owe a debt of kindness to one another. I think it's even expressed in those words in one of the episodes of the show. In other words, there are ways that we ought and ought not to behave based upon an action's effects on other people. So one of the philosophers that's mentioned is a gentleman by the name of T.M. Scanlon. He taught moral philosophy at Harvard up until 2016 when he retired, and he wrote this book entitled What We Owe to Each Other. And this book presents his brand of something called contractualism. And this is a theory that humans are obligated to act in ways that can be reasonably justified to the people who are impacted by those actions. And so Scanlon's book makes several appearances in the show. Sometimes we see the title written out on Chidi's chalkboard. Sometimes we see the title page out of the actual book flashes on the screen. But this kind of happens periodically through the episodes, and it kind of reinforces the running theme that is expressed in other ways throughout the series. So there's situation after situation in which the human characters could have chosen to be selfish and just look out for number one, or they can choose to be sacrificial and they can do things that help the other human characters. And as it happens in the show, the latter choice, choosing to help the others, always results in good for everybody involved. So it seems like there's this very clear message that we do owe those around us this debt of kindness, as it's sometimes referred to. And interestingly, I've actually had this idea come up in conversation before. Several years ago with a young atheist woman, I was teaching a class on objective morality, and I was talking about the impossibility of grounding morality without the existence of God. And this is what The Good Place is trying to do. But this atheist young woman raised her hand and she said, well, we should just choose to be helpful to other people because we'll all benefit in the long run. So I scratch your back, you scratch mine, and that way society continues. That's just rational. And in response, I pointed out to this young woman that at the end of the day, that attitude seems to me to be fundamentally selfish because you're treating others in a certain way just because you want benefits in return. And then I gave her some examples of various situations where someone could treat others quite terribly in order to get ahead in their life and totally get away with it and never suffer any negative consequences. So the question becomes, if we could be reasonably certain from one situation to the next that we could get away with actions that are very self-serving at the expense of other people, then why should we refrain from doing those things? And you can't answer that on this idea. So in my article, I point out also that the theory of evolution by natural selection includes competition for survival and then survival of the fittest. And there's a Christian scientist by the name of Carl Giberson. He's actually a proponent of theistic evolution. He is very prominent in the whole creation evolution debate, but he has repeatedly argued that human evolution progressed by way of selfish behavior through competition with other members of the population for things like resources and for mates. And so we have to ask, why shouldn't we orchestrate all of our actions for our very own benefit. Why shouldn't we only care about our own survival and reproduction, to use the evolutionary terms? And sometimes that would mean helping others because we want them to help us in return. We want something back. But there would be times when it would mean hurting other people when we can get away with it. And if it's something that by hurting them, we are personally better off in some pragmatic way. But if God doesn't exist, then no one has the right to say that we owe anybody anything. So why shouldn't we all be what philosophers call psychological egoists, who choose things only out of self-preservation and self-promotion? And on the show, on The Good Place, that's exactly the kind of life Eleanor lived on Earth. She was always only concerned with herself. Everything was inherently selfish in the way she behaved. And she actually got by quite well. I mean, we never have seen an earthly scene from her life where she did something out of selfish reasons for a benefit to her own self that hurt other people, and then she had any sort of regret or any sort of backlash that really impacted her very much at all. And so we really end up with this big question of why shouldn't we only be inherently selfish in our choices about how to behave towards other people?
Well, we've mentioned a couple of times the character Chidi, who was a moral philosophy professor in his earthly life. And he is specifically, I think, a really interesting character because he is super indecisive. I mean, he has crisis after crisis that they show him having, whether it's in the afterlife or specifically when he was on Earth, that he can't make any decisions. And that's really frustrating to family and friends because he just thinks through the ramification of every small detail of each decision, and then he's paralyzed. So that seems like a very interesting irony to explore, that he's this moral philosophy professor and yet he himself can't make, you know, moral decisions. So can you explain what you think about that character?
Yes, Chidi is my very favorite character on the show. And I found myself laughing so many times because things that would thrill Chidi are things that would thrill me too in real life. And it just made me realize how geeky I am about this stuff. So he's a fascinating character. He desperately wants to live a good moral life. So we see in Chidi this purity of character, really, that, spoiler alert, we really don't see with any of the other human characters on the show. But like you said, he's constantly plagued with indecision and internal conflict about ethical decision making. He thinks he's chosen the best available option for his moral philosophy, but it turns out that in practice, it's often completely unlivable. And as I take a step back and I ask, well, by including a character like this and showing these ironic conflicts in his life, what are the show's writers trying to say? To me, it suggests the idea that man-made systems of morality, even those favored by people like Chidi, a character who's carefully studied moral philosophy for years on end, at the end of the day, these are still systems that somehow eventually break down in some way. And as Christians, we can say, yes, absolutely, that's exactly what happens when you try to have a man-made system of moral philosophy or a man-made system of ethics. I don't think the writers intended this message for reasons that seem to be becoming clear, especially in the most recent season of the show. But still, I think it's a message that comes through naturally.
So in your article, you outlined two of the theories of morality in the show. And can you tell us a little bit more about those two theories?
Sure. So there are theories of several different Western philosophers that are at least mentioned on the show, but there are two that really get a disproportionate amount of screen time, either explicitly or just implicitly in the dialogue between the characters or in the situations that they find themselves in. The first is Kantian deontology. And this is the view that Chidi likes. He tends to favor it above the other views, even if there are elements of different views that he will often express liking or respect for. So Kant believed that decisions about how we should act in a given situation can be made by using what he called pure practical reasoning. And we pair this kind of reasoning with a central principle. And this is how he said it. He said, act only according to the maxim whereby you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law. So that's a fancy way of saying that you ask yourself, if everyone in the world did what you're considering doing, would that world be desirable? So if everybody did it, would that be a good world to live in? And if the answer is no, then you ought not to do that thing. And this is what Kant called his categorical imperative. So for example, Chidi's convinced that lying is always and everywhere wrong, regardless of the circumstances and any potential consequences. After all, you can reason to the fact that a world in which lying was considered acceptable would be a horribly dysfunctional world if people just went around lying about everything. So Chidi tries so hard to live out this Kantian idea that you should never, ever, ever tell a lie, but then he winds up in situations that illustrate some of the problems with not being able to consider situations on a case-by-case basis. So there's this one scene where a coworker shows up to the university campus wearing these horrendously tacky red rhinestone cowboy boots. And he's like, hey, Chidi, what do you think of my boots? And you can see it on Chidi's face that he abhors the boots, but he's so worried about hurting his friend's feelings and he breaks down and he tells a lie. And then he's consumed with guilt for the longest time. And finally, to alleviate his guilt, because he thinks he has to be this good Kantian, right? That lying is always and everywhere wrong for everybody. He fesses up to the friend and he says, I hate the boots. He comes out and tells the truth, even though he knows it's going to really hurt his friend's feelings. So just an example of how this categorical imperative ends up leading to some really problematic situations. But one thing it does have going for it is that it's one of the systems that is concerned with our motives for our actions. So early on in the first season, Chidi explains to Eleanor that good actions simply aren't enough. They're not the whole story. That you have to have unselfish motives for your good actions, or they really don't ultimately count as good by definition. So a character that we've briefly mentioned already, a young woman named Tahani, is a perfect illustration of this. So on Earth, she had been this philanthropist who worked tirelessly to raise billions and billions of dollars for all these various charities. And countless people benefited from all her work in fundraising. But deep down, Tahani was entirely driven by this selfish desire for things like public recognition and admiration. And she was on this mission to one-up her sister, who was like the family golden child. And so what's really great about all the examples that we get to see of Tahani acting in really good ways, but for very selfish reasons, is that as viewers of the show, our moral intuition is engaged. We watch these scenes and we just know, we just somehow know that motives really matter when it comes to judging a person's character. It's not just about the outward actions. And so if this is right, then theories of morality that don't take our motives into account have to be rejected. So then the other major theory that the show talks about besides the Kantian view is something called utilitarianism. And this is somewhat like the idea that was expressed by the young atheist woman that I mentioned earlier. So utilitarianism is only concerned with how much goodness or how much badness an action introduces into the world or into human society. So in other words, it's only the consequences of actions that matter, which is why it's classified in philosophy as a type of consequentialism. To help society flourish, we ought to do what produces the most good and best minimizes pain and suffering. And when Chidi explains this to Eleanor, she immediately latches onto it. And she's like, I like this one. Why didn't we just start with this one? And Chidi has to warn her. He says, Eleanor, if all that matters is the sum total of goodness that actions produce, then what happens is you can justify any number of bad actions. And he gives the example of torturing one innocent person to save 100 people. And then in a much later episode, there are a couple of great thought experiments that the characters have to live out. And these demonstrate some of the major flaws of utilitarianism. So they do the famous trolley experiment. It's actually kind of gross. We get to see a bit of blood and gore in that experiment. And then they do the doctor-patient thought experiment where the doctor has to kill one healthy person to save five others by taking the healthy person's organs. And I think these scenes, these vivid illustrations, are particularly useful in apologetics-oriented conversations about why utilitarianism simply can't be the entire story of human morality. So you end up in these unworkable dilemmas, and you can't take into account what someone's motive, what their inner character is when it comes to how they behave. Motives are just completely disregarded on that account. So those are the two. We have Kantian deontology and then utilitarianism. They're not the only two theories, but they're the ones that really feature most prominently all throughout the show, sometimes separately and sometimes in a sort of hybrid form.
So is there ever a theory of morality on The Good Place that they mention that doesn't suffer from some of the shortcomings that you just mentioned of the Kantian view or utilitarianism?
Well, kind of, but not completely. So in a couple of episodes, Aristotelian virtue ethics is very briefly talked about. Chidi introduces Aristotle. He kind of defines Aristotelian virtue ethics, which is the theory that there are these things called objective human virtues, things like courage and generosity. And these virtues are things that we should cultivate in ourselves. And we do this by doing virtuous actions. And that results in our becoming more virtuous people. And when we become more virtuous people, we flourish. So the inner character of a person matters. And the idea is that humans have a nature that flourishes when we pursue the virtues. And so as Christians, we can absolutely affirm this idea in the Christian worldview. But what the show doesn't say is that we have to have some sort of objective grounding for the concept of virtue in the first place. In other words, who gets to define what's virtuous and what's not virtuous? If we look at history and if we look at even contemporary society on a global scale, different people groups at different times in history and in different places have had very, very different perspectives on what virtue is, what it means to live virtuously. And so that tells us that if we're going to have such thing as virtue that's true for everybody and every time and place, we have to have a transcendent objective standards, something that's not man-made. In Christianity, we have that. We have the perfectly loving and good character of an eternal creator God. And in addition to that, we're made in his image. And so we flourish when we emulate the character of God. And that's very much in line with the basic premise of Aristotelian virtue ethics. But unfortunately, because the show avoids the topic of religion and avoids the topic of God altogether, we just get these brief mentions of Aristotle's idea and no discussion on what it really needs to become a viable philosophy.
So specifically, just thinking about the title of your article about using the good place in conversational apologetics, what are some other ways that this series could be useful in doing so?
In the article, I highlight two points that I think are especially useful in conversational apologetics. So first of all, the entire premise of the show breaks down if we don't have the assumption that human beings have genuine free will. In other words, that we're able to choose our actions, that we are free moral agents. If that isn't true, then there's really no such thing as morality. As one atheist philosopher has put it before, we're just meat robots. We're these meat robots that operate according to our DNA and environmental pressures. And there's this one episode on the show where the question of free will is brought up. It's actually quite late. It's somewhere in the third season, I think. And so the conversation is on whether or not human beings have free will. And Eleanor says, "Everything in my life has been determined by my upbringing, my genetics, or my environment. There's no such thing as free will." And now, many theist philosophers, but also some non-theist philosophers, have argued that if materialism is true, if there's no such thing as an immaterial human soul, then it is true that everything we do is physically determined, that there can't be any such thing as free will, which means there's no free moral agency. And this would mean that morality is totally an illusion, and that there can't be any such thing as moral accountability for any action. To say that you should or should not do something for moral reasons just turns out to be absurd. So the show, The Good Place, assumes the existence of souls that survive the death of the body. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a show about the afterlife. And it refers to them as personal essences. It doesn't call them souls. And it also has to assume this reality of moral free will. But what's interesting is it doesn't connect these two things. I find that rather fascinating, but I also see why they can't, because then you're kind of in religious territory. And the other point I think is really useful in conversational apologetics is the idea that we've already touched on a few times, and that is the idea of objective moral values and objective moral duties. The show assumes this kind of objectivity, but it never offers any grounding for it whatsoever. We see all these positive and negative points values for all these various actions, but we have to ask, well, who came up with those? What mathematical standard are they based on? There's no God in The Good Place. There's only this judge who says she was born right after the Big Bang. So there isn't a transcendent eternal source of objective morality. And I think that's a really interesting point to bring up, because it's sort of a hole in the plot of the show. They have all these standards, mathematical standards even, that have been built in to the cosmic moral economy, but there's no explanation of where they could possibly have come from.
Well, in the first three seasons, do you have a favorite episode, and which one is it? I wish I remembered specifically which episode I liked the best, but one of them, what caught my attention was the question when they were trying to figure out, you know, this mathematical standard, you do so many good things, but then this one thing that you did, or maybe you did a good thing, but it was for the wrong reason. It's like, okay, Tahani was really in competition with her sister, so then those were negative points. Like, how do you balance your positive and negative points? But at one point, one of the characters had this thought of, well, how can I ever be good enough to get all the good points that I need? So I thought that was a really good episode that stuck out in my mind, but I can't remember which specific one it was. What was your favorite episode so far?
If I had to choose just one, it would be one that was entitled Existential Crisis, and it comes in the second season. I can't say who it is for listeners who have not yet watched the show, but have decided to listen to this podcast anyway. But there's a very important character on the show who begins to contemplate the idea of the ultimate end of his personal existence. And so this sends him into this full-blown existential crisis. And he becomes paralyzed by a sense of meaninglessness and absurdity in the universe. And when other characters ask what in the world is wrong with him, Chidi explains, he says he's having an existential crisis. It's a sort of anguish people go through when they contemplate the silent indifference of our empty universe. Look, the good news is, if he can work through this, it's the first step towards understanding human ethics. And then he goes on and he says, an existential crisis is an acknowledgement that life is absurd and that absurdity needs to be confronted. So that is such a great scene. And I love the dialogue. It's just excellent. And then the character in crisis, he just yells out, searching for meaning is philosophical suicide. How does anyone do anything when you understand the fleeting nature of existence? So the question is, if our existence comes to an end, as the materialists claim, then it is true that life is ultimately meaningless and it's ultimately hopeless. And there's kind of this touching moment later in the episode where Eleanor's talking to the character who has had the existential crisis. And she says, all humans are aware of death, so we're all a little bit sad all the time. That's just the deal. And I thought that was such a revealing statement. We all know we're going to die, and we all feel that death is this really sad thing. It's even something we could describe as an evil thing. And we feel like things just shouldn't be this way. But we have to ask, why shouldn't things be this way? This was a point that C.S. Lewis explored at great length in his book, Mere Christianity. But one of the other reasons besides the marvelous dialogue in this episode, one of the other reasons I like it so much is because it reminded me of a lecture that I heard when I first started graduate school about 10 years ago. And it was a lecture that went on to have a huge impact on me. And I still go back and listen to it a few times a year. It was given by Dr. William Lane Craig at a university. I can't remember which one, but the title of the lecture was The Absurdity of Life Without God. And if you go to his website, Reasonable Faith, you can actually read the transcript. They have it archived on there. And I think if you go to YouTube, there might be an old, old blurry video of him actually giving the lecture. But anyway, as I watched and I rewatched this particular episode of The Good Place, I kept thinking about Dr. Craig's arguments in that lecture, where he basically says that without both immortality and the existence of God, life cannot have any objective meaning, value, or purpose. Human existence is just fundamentally absurd. And the only rational position when it comes to philosophy is nihilism. If we don't have both personal immortality and the existence of God, then anything other than nihilism is just make-believe. We're just pretending that there's meaning in our life. We're just making things like that up as we go.
So this show, you know, creates this whole afterlife where God does not exist. And there are some philosophers who have written books, probably one of the most well-known ones, because a lot of his books, you know, sold at a popular level, is the late Christopher Hitchens. And he was an atheist that claimed, yeah, people can live a good moral life without believing in God. And, you know, there's very famous atheists who've, you know, talked about this and that there can be meaning and purpose without religion. So how do we respond to that claim. And especially because this, you know, show kind of puts that forth. It's not a theistic, it's not a Christian afterlife or universe or anything like that.
Yeah, it's kind of a situation of wanting to have your cake and eat it too. And we have to caution our fellow Christians that when you get in conversations with a non-believer who says, "Of course I can live a good moral life without God," what they really mean when they say that is they can live a good moral life without believing in God. And we need to affirm that. We need to say, yes, of course an atheist can live an upstanding, morally praiseworthy kind of life. Of course they can. We're not claiming otherwise. What we are claiming is, in order for there to be any such thing as good and evil, as objective morality, there has to be a transcendent standard. And the only option for such a standard is a transcendent, eternal, perfectly loving creator God, which is what Christianity claims exists. So you referred to some of the philosophers like Christopher Hitchens who try to have their cake and eat it too. And one of these philosophers happens to be one that was a consultant for the writers of The Good Place. His name is Dr. Todd May, and he works at Clemson University. And he's written several short books that explore how we can seek to be good and we can find our own version of meaning and purpose in life, even if the universe is at bottom a dark and indifferent place. One of his books is actually entitled A Significant Life, Human Meaning in a Silent Universe. And I checked it out from the library last week. I've only had a chance to read the first couple of chapters, so I can't comment a whole lot about his philosophy any more broadly than that, just that he's attempting to build this worldview in which there is goodness and meaning in human life, even if at the end of the day, the universe is silent and doesn't offer us any sort of transcendent meaning and purpose. But many atheists who refuse to accept the meaninglessness of the universe take very similar routes. And they say, well, we just create all this meaning and purpose for ourselves. Isn't it better to live that way than to despair with the absurdity of life in this indifferent cosmos? But that really misses the larger point. And the point being, if we are people who care about truth and rationality, and these atheists would say they are those kinds of people, they care about truth and rationality, then shouldn't it bother them that they have to live a life based on make-believe, that they just have to invent sources of meaning, value, and purpose because there's nothing objective to ground it in such that it's a fundamental reality of human existence?
So there's a lot of reviews of the show out there that have mentioned college professors using The Good Place in the classroom. And why do you think it's become so popular among, you know, specifically probably philosophy instructors? I think for me, it really makes what could be a very dry and unengaging topic to make real practical sense, especially because there's so many pop culture references. When you think of the character of Tahani, if you have just some, you know, student that wasn't just taking this kind of like, oh, I guess I'll just take philosophy, but didn't really have an interest in it. I think some of the characters and their past, what they did in their life on Earth could really appeal to students.
Yes, I totally agree. In addition to that, there's all these really colorful and often very funny illustrations of all the different philosophical ideas and dilemmas that are explored on the show. And those are such a fun way to just help students grasp the concepts, get them interested enough to think about what's going on. And everybody who's ever taught any kind of class whatsoever knows that students are much more likely to engage when the discussion is entertaining and when they can see relevance to popular culture. So I think that's why it's becoming so popular among philosophy instructors. But I also think, and I can speak for myself here, it's always very, very exciting when pop culture, such as a television show, expresses interest in things that are often isolated to university conversations. So it's cool to see the crossover.
I mentioned that you teach philosophy courses at Houston Baptist. So do you talk about this show with some of your own students?
I haven't had a chance to yet, but this fall I'm teaching a philosophy of religion course that's been revamped to include a section on the topic of God and ethics. And so I will actually be using a few short scenes from the show. But also, if you go on YouTube, there's some great bonus content that NBC has uploaded into the Good Place YouTube channel. And there are four videos that are actually narrated by Dr. Todd May, where he unpacks some of the major concepts presented on the show. And it's very well done with great animations. So I'll definitely be using those.
Do you think The Good Place, you know, raises any useful discussion points that we can have with fellow believers?
I do. So the point of my article was that we can use the show in conversational apologetics. And when I say conversational apologetics, I do mainly mean skeptics, conversations with skeptics. But I think it does offer some interesting discussion material for situations where we may have a Christian friend who hasn't been well taught and holds to like a works-based model of salvation, or to use the theological term, justification before God. In other words, they have this idea that God will save you if you just do enough good in your life. And the show, The Good Place, is such a great illustration of the impossibility of leading a morally perfect life, and also the impossibility of ever being able to answer the question, how good is good enough? And I think that opens the door to some really good conversations on human fallenness, our inability to save ourselves, and the biblical doctrine of justification by grace through faith in Christ.
So I mentioned that this fourth season is their last season. And again, it premieres on September 26th. And it's going to kind of close out all the storylines. I think they decided there's, you know, only so much you can do. It can't keep going. They have to kind of bring everything to a close. So without giving too many spoilers away of the first three seasons, which we've kind of gone around because we've basically just talked about specific characters and maybe some situations, but not a ton of plot spoilers, can you speculate maybe on how you think it's going to end?
Oh my goodness. This almost keeps me up at night. I keep formulating all these different theories in my head of how they could possibly wrap up the show. On the philosophical level, I guess we have to expect that there's going to be some sort of shallow resolution based on the idea that, as Todd May says in one of his books, we just have to do the best we can. And then this idea that we just create meaning and purpose for ourselves, and it'll just all work out for the best in the end. I'm guessing philosophically that's where it's going to wind up, because I really don't know what else they can do if they're completely avoiding the topic of God and religion. But as far as what happens with the human characters, for those who have been watching the show, you know what's going on. You know what their end goal is. And so with that in mind, I will say I've become very suspicious that Chidi, the moral philosopher, might be the key to the ultimate resolution of the plot line. I'm imagining that just maybe all four seasons of the show will end up turning out to be one big illustration after another illustration that take place over a semester in his real life moral philosophy classroom. Like, we're going to find out all of this has just been Chidi teaching at the university and using thought experiments with his students. But that's just my speculation. I guess we'll find out.
Well, I can see that happening. I just hope it's not like so many other TV series where they just wake up and it was a dream.
Oh, totally. Yes. I hope not.
So hopefully it won't be that solution, because they've had that for a lot of various different series. Well, finally, I like to ask Melissa some fun rapid fire questions. So Melissa, ice or no ice in your water?
Oh, ice.
Sneakers or high heels?
Sneakers.
Drive or fly?
Drive.
For home projects, do you do it yourself or do you hire a professional?
Oh, hire a professional.
Shop online or go to the store?
Shop online.
Well, thanks, Melissa, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Today's guest is Melissa Kane Travis, and Melissa has written an online exclusive television series review. It's available free at our website, equip.org, and it's called Using NBC's The Good Place in Conversational Apologetics. We'd also like to invite you to subscribe to our journal, and a subscription is $33.50, and you can do that by heading over to our website, equip.org. And again, our website's not under a paywall. So if you have been enjoying this podcast and also all of these free online reviews and feature articles and book reviews, we'd appreciate it if you'd team up with us either with a small tip, $3 to $5, $10, or a subscription to our print edition of the Christian Research Journal for $33.50. And we are very grateful for your support. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and please rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others see our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.